The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Jennifer Egan won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award for the novel A Visit from the Goon Squad. Her other books of fiction include Manhattan Beach, winner of the Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction, the National Book Award finalist Look at Me, the best-selling The Keep, and The Invisible Circus, which was adapted into a 2001 film. She joins us this evening with The Candy House, a sibling novel to A Visit from the Goon Squad, about the quest for authenticity and meaning in a world where memories and identities are no longer private. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Arielle Delgado Dixon, who recently graced our stage with her propulsive debut novel, Don't Say We Didn't Warn You. Please join me in welcoming our guests back to the Free Library.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Hello to those on live stream. I have a feeling there are more of you doing that than being here than there would have been if the lightning weren't happening outside. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me. And I'm going to start by just reading for a short period, and then I'm looking forward to our conversation and to your questions. So I'm going to just read the beginning of one of the chapters of this book, which is not representative of anything other than its own chapter, because they're each very different from all the others. It has two titles, which are A Journey and A Stranger Comes to Town. And the narrator is Miles. My cousin Sasha had lived in the desert for 20 years before I discovered she had become an artist. I was looking at her kids' social media stories, as I often did with people I used to know, to see how they'd aged and try to gauge their happiness, when I saw a post from her son, proud of my mom, with a link to an article about Sasha in Art News. The picture showed dozens of hot air balloons suspended above rambling, colorful sculptures stretched out across the California desert. According to the article, Sasha made these forms out of discarded plastic. Later, she melted the sculptures down to create compressed bricks that had been displayed and sold along with aerial photos of that same plastic and sculptural form at art galleries. Sasha, what the hell? If anyone had required proof that life's outcomes are impossible to predict, this development would have supplied it. Sasha had been a fuck-up all the way into her 30s, a kleptomaniac who'd managed to pilfer countless items from countless people over countless years. How did I know? Because right before she married Drew in 2008, she started returning things. Everyone in the family received an item or two, sometimes of so little value that it was amazing Sasha remembered what belonged to whom. My dad got a Bic pen, the kind they sold in bags of 20 at Staples. I too received a pen, but mine was a Mont Blanc worth several hundred dollars. I'd nearly had a brain hemorrhage when it vanished after a family dinner at a Korean restaurant while I was visiting New York. I'd phoned the restaurant, the taxi authority, the MTA. I'd retraced my steps through Koreatown, bent at the waist to scrutinize gutters. When that very same pen showed up in my mailbox a couple of years later with a handwritten note that began, "Since my teenage years, I have struggled with a compulsion to steal, which has been a source of great anguish to me and of loss and frustration to many others," I called my dad. "I know," he said, "I got a Bic. I'm not even sure it's mine. It might have belonged to the restaurant." Can we please be done with her, Dad? I asked once and for all. She's incorrigible. She's the opposite of incorrigible, he said. She's making amends. I don't want her amends. I want her to disappear. What makes you say things like that, Miles? I remember exactly where I was standing when we had that conversation. On the deck of the lakeside Winnetka home, Trudy and I had over-leveraged ourselves to buy. She was pregnant with Polly, our first, and painstakingly decorated together the site of a planned domestic idyll of children, holidays, and family reunions that we'd rapturously envisioned ever since meeting in law school at the University of Chicago. Holding my phone, looking out at twinkling Lake Michigan, I understood with sudden clarity that doing the right thing, being right, gets you nothing in this world. It's the sinners everyone loves, the flailers, the scramblers, the bumblers. There's nothing sexy about getting it right the first time. Fuck Sasha, I thought. I'm fully aware that Sasha emerges from these descriptions as sympathetic, whereas I come off as a moralizing prig. I was a moralizing prig, and not just toward my cousin. My father, who treated Sasha as a daughter and whom I saw as her enabler. My mother, whose romantic adventures since my parents' divorce I found sickening. My younger brothers, Ames and Alfred, both of whom I deemed lost before they turned 25. No one escaped the roving, lacerating beam of my judgment. I can access that beam even now, decades later, a font of outraged impatience with other people's flaws. How had the human species managed to survive for millennia? How had we built civilizations and invented antibiotics when practically no one, other than Trudy and me, seemed capable of sucking it up and just getting things done? If anything can be said in defense of the person I was in 2008, the year Sasha made amends and Polly was born, the year I turned 30, it can only be that I was least forgiving of myself. Every move I made was aimed at harrying myself toward greater excellence. But certain things, like sleep, resist rigid control. In high school, my insomnia had made it possible to excel academically while also playing three varsity sports, working for a tree pruning company, and pleasing a finicky girlfriend. I bridged the gaps with peanut butter, which I ate by the jar, and teenage energy. But Polly was colicky, and by then I was the youngest partner in my law firm's history, and the workload was crushing. I started taking sleeping pills at night and Adderall in the morning to get me going, and eventually throughout the day to keep me sharp. When the Adderall made me jangly, I'd calm down with Xanax or Percocet in the afternoon before knocking myself out with more sleeping pills at bedtime. I saw this metabolic tinkering as nothing more than taking care of business. And the ease with which I chemically managed my deficits, coupled with a slight drug nausea I often felt, made me doubly impatient with everyone else. I became, as they say, irritable. Hard to work for and harder to live with. My high standards intensified the pressure I felt personally, which meant that I wasn't home with our kids enough, 3 and 5 years, in keeping with our plan, or much of a partner for Trudy, who had suspended her law career to enable our child rearing, sexually or in any other way. All of which made me more irritable, because I sensed that I was failing when all I'd ever done my whole life was try to succeed. To the naked eye, things still looked fine at that point. I was bringing in business and seeing it through, albeit at the cost of some popularity at my firm. At home, everyone seemed happy. As I reminded myself daily by checking Trudy's Facebook, later her Instagram feed, she was a genius at capturing offhand moments and making them look iconic. Scrolling through her trips to the beach, the park, the zoo, often with our neighbor Jana and her 4 kids, ice cream dribbling from chins, a video of crayoned pinwheels twirling in the breeze, I could actually feel my heartbeat slow, my blood calm. Any fragment of time I'd managed to wrest from work and spend with them was always front and center, and I gorged on Trudy's shots of Polly hugging me, of Michael, our older son, throwing me a ball, of me spooning mashed bananas into the mouth of Timothy, our baby. Everything was fine, I told myself, drawing deep breaths at my cherry wood desk in my towering, glassy office. They were still there, still happy. We were happy, all five of us in our beautiful home by the lake, exactly as Trudy and I had fantasized after making love between law school classes, just waiting for me to come back. In 2013, with the opioid crisis exploding, my doctor, until then a trusting prescriber of whatever I told him I needed, abruptly put the screws on. The prospect of being cut off from my prescriptions awakened in me a naked terror. I could no more function without those pills than I could without oxygen. My sleep, my focus, my ability to work and relax, all of that would end. I would end. With a sense of having swallowed a stick of live dynamite whose fuse was rapidly burning down, I lurched through actions that seemed alien to me even as I took them. First, groveling for my doctor to renew my prescriptions, then raising my fist at him and being dismissed as his patient, drawing skeptical looks from potential new doctors when I cataloged my needs, two sent me away with literature on treatment programs, driving to pill mills in surrounding towns where doctors who looked more strung out than I was wrote scripts with shaking hands, and finally, on learning that Illinois would soon be enacting a prescription drug registry to keep people like me from collecting scripts from multiple doctors, forking over several hundred dollars to a pill mill doc in exchange for an introduction to a bona fide drug dealer. I'm going to stop there.
Thanks for reading. I'm so happy to be here. I have been a huge fan for so long, like many of you, I'm sure. I feel like it's only right to start at the beginning. I know this book has been called a sibling novel to A Visit from the Goon Squad, which seems like a really specific word, not sequel, but sibling. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between the Candy House and Goon Squad.
Sure. I mean, the reason I call it is, are these working? Okay, good. The reason I call it a sibling is that to me, a sequel suggests either that it's necessary to have read the earlier one or that the experience would definitely be enhanced, or even more, that it takes place later in time, that it actually follows the other chronologically. And these books are not chronological to begin with. You know, I move around in time through both of them. And I don't think I don't think there's any reason to necessarily read Goon Squad first. In fact, I've come to feel that it would work better going the other direction. So, and in fact, I did not reread Goon Squad myself.
Interesting.
I hadn't read the book since whatever, probably actually earlier, before you guys or whoever has read it, because I didn't reread it after it was published, except in pieces. Anyway, the bottom line was, I discovered I'd made a lot of errors when I reread it. I had actually changed people's biographies in ways that really wasn't acceptable. And it was actually kind of hard. In a couple of cases, I had to sort of unravel certain things and change them. So on the other hand, obviously the two books are related. Mm-hmm. I have the same kind of the same principles at work formally, which basically are that each chapter is about a different person. Each chapter has a different kind of world and texture and feel, and usually along with that, kind of a different craft approach. Mm-hmm. And then each chapter stands on its own. So I knew I wanted to do that again, and I used a lot of very peripheral characters from Goon Squad, some of them so peripheral we've only heard their names, never even actually seen them. So somehow sibling felt like the right way to describe that relationship.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I found myself when I was reading The Candy House trying to go back in my memory to see which characters were from the visit from the Goon Squad, and wasn't always quite sure if they had appeared there peripherally or not. But I was wondering how you chose or how you settled upon which characters to draw out from Goon Squad, especially the peripheral ones who maybe just appeared in mentions.
Well, The organizing principle or the driver of both books is really my curiosity and hopefully the reader's curiosity. Hopefully we align in that way. So it feels like the way that I tend to choose what to write about is that something catches my interest sort of from the corner of my eye. And there's something about that situation that makes me want to look at it more closely. It could be a situation or it could be a person. And with Goon Squad, there were a lot of things I tried that didn't work, and even more with this one, actually. So every time that happens, I try something and it doesn't work, what that means is that I've explored characters and sort of learned things about them that now the reader doesn't know because it didn't work. So this sense of knowing more than the reader knows is a little uncomfortable. I don't usually have that. Like, my books are often very open-ended, but I don't know more. If I leave questions unanswered, it's because I don't know the answers. Yeah. But in this case, I felt sort of like that wasn't true. I actually did know some answers, and it was just very natural to follow my curiosity into more characters, which I began doing while on my book tour for Goon Squad.
Wow.
Yeah. There's the chapter called, probably the most structurally weird, a chapter called Lulu the Spy, was published in 2012 and tweeted by The New Yorker as a kind of a novella. I actually shortened it for this book, called Black Box. And I was writing that on my book tour. And I know that because I date everything since I write by hand. And it's funny because I was sometimes like eating out alone because I would be in a place where I didn't know anyone. And so I would work on this this rough draft. And there are pages that have food splotches on them that I know are from some of those meals. So it's really an art. It never stopped, clearly.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit more about that chapter? I was going to save that for a little later, but since we're talking about it, Lulu the Spy 2032. So I know it's a set of tweets, 140 character bursts, but it's kind of a thrill ride of a chapter with a lot of heart still. Could you talk about the process of writing that? And that was the first kickoff for this book?
Yeah, I mean, it was in the sense that I hoped if I wrote another book involving characters from Goon Squad that it could house that chapter. But I wasn't... It was a tall order because the chapter itself was so strange. And actually, one of the things that I was about to say wasted time on, but I don't like that language because if you work on something that doesn't work out, often there's a way that eventually the material comes back into focus. But trying to find a way to follow the protagonist of that character, Lulu, into some other situation was... It's not an exaggeration to say that hundreds of pages that I attempted did not work. But anyway, the way I came to write that chapter or that story, novella as it was then, I've thought about it a lot, actually, because I've been thinking a lot about how much writing fiction is like dreaming. The way that it's such a process of waiting to see what my unconscious washes up and then trying to pick the best of that and turn it into something interesting. And I think in the same way that dreams draw on all kinds of little elements of our lives and transform them into ways that are sometimes unrecognizable, sometimes very recognizable, there were various strands of my daily life that met in Black Box. And one of them was that I was reading a book to my kids again and again and again and again, because that's how it is when you read to kids. And it was David Wiesner's The Three Pigs, if anyone knows that book here, a beautifully illustrated book. The conceit of it is that the three pigs, to escape the wolf, who's about to eat the first of them, pop out of the book that they're in, and the wolf can't find the first pig. He's looking under the doormat because the text continues to as the story would normally be, and in this version, the wolf eats the pig, but there is no pig. So the escaped pigs, which appear like naturalistic pigs when they leave the story, start going in and out of other storybooks, and they're drawn differently. They're drawn according to the style of the book they enter. So in one, they're drawn in pen and ink. In one, they're drawn in a cartoon style, and that's a book of nursery rhymes. And when they're in the book of nursery rhymes, they encourage the cat who's playing the fiddle in Hey Diddle Diddle to escape with them. And so the cartoon cat steps, there's actually an illustration of the cat's paw leaving the cartoon world, and it looks like a real cat's paw on the other side. I just could not believe a book I was reading to my kids was so smart and meta. And I also couldn't believe they loved it. I thought, like, how can we both be enjoying this book so much? But it got me thinking about whether I could do that same thing that David Wiesner was doing visually, which was take a character I had used in a naturalistic setting and import that character into a genre story and draw them differently, as it were. So that was one kind of wish. And then another one was, I'm very interested in lists as a form of inadvertent storytelling. And I keep a ridiculous number of lists on my phone. Ridiculous because I then forget about them and they just accumulate. But they're kind of interesting artifacts because lists tell a story without trying to. Think about it, even a grocery list does that. So the list that really made me laugh when I discovered it a few years later was called Lessons Learned. And it was my list of things that I wanted to do differently in the future. And it was like very random, but also pretty mundane. Like one was buy a narrower Christmas tree. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, that's right, because we bought that really fat Christmas tree, and it blocked all the light from our living room. And then my favorite was, put train ticket in bag the night before, always, in all caps. So, of course, you immediately see, okay, we know what went wrong there. So I thought, oh, it would be so fun to write a whole story in the form of Lessons Learned, where the action is never described. It's only inferred. Yeah. So that was another wish. Then I had a wish to use Twitter because anything I see that seems narrative, I want to use. So those three notions were floating around for probably years. And then the way I actually that's all well and good, but that does not equal fiction. Sometimes I hope it will, but in the end, something has to happen on the page. And for me, the key to that is a time and a place. If I start to have a sense of atmosphere, then I can enter into a story of some sort, which I write, pretty intuitively and blindly. And then some of these ideas and wishes, if I'm lucky, converge around it. So that's really how it happened. I took a character who was very peripheral in Goon Squad, but drawn naturalistically, and I imported her into a pretty genre-esque and, border, if it were written conventionally, I think it would read as very cartoonish. Hopefully it doesn't in this form, but a spy story.
Yeah. I can see what you mean about time and place setting being important when you're crafting those. I think about the PowerPoint presentation of Goon Squad, and we still have the desert sort of setting the scene even there.
The desert was the only reason I could do that, because I had tried using PowerPoint a number of other times, and it really is not easy to write fiction in PowerPoint. More people aren't doing it, I'll tell you. You can't portray action. It's a totally atomized form. And it has a cold corporate vibe.
Yeah.
So it's not conducive. And I kept finding that I would start trying to write fiction in PowerPoint and I would end up just writing narratively, which was a sign that I was grafting or imposing the form on the story. But when I started to think about the desert, and I barely have been to the desert. It seems amazing from a distance. I have a slight sense of the desert from like Palm Springs, California, but that sense of sort of the big sparkling parking lot, the dry air, somehow I was able to enter it because of the desert.
That makes sense to me. I think the desert is kind of spooky and magical that way. But since we're talking about the PowerPoint presentation, the tweets chapter, I also wanted to bring up another favorite part of this book for me, which was the chapter told in email-like exchanges, which has a whole slew of characters communicating, sometimes in one-word emails behind other people's backs, sometimes in long, more narrative stretches, but it just felt, it gave me a real voyeuristic thrill just being able to peek in on those. And so much happens just in, I don't know, the polite exchange of emails and that sort of language between people. But could you talk a little bit about writing that? And I mean, it's got kind of an expansive scope in the characters involved.
Well, it's interesting. That is actually where I landed after my many failed efforts to revisit the spy that I imported out of the naturalistic form she was in Goon Squad. So you know, I felt like if I was going to include that chapter, I couldn't just leave her where we find her at the end of that chapter, because that makes sense in a genre piece, but in a way what I was trying to do in this book was use different genres for each chapter. So we can't just leave her dangling as she is dangling, which I'm not explaining because I don't want to ruin it for those who haven't read it. But, you know, I struggled and struggled to find a way to see her back in her normal civilian life, because the conceit of this chapter is that she's working for the government, but as a civilian agent, a citizen agent, she's called. And the idea there is that no one can check on her, no one can catch her, because she has no history, no training, and her job is just to infiltrate this group of malevolent people doing we're not sure what, and record their conversation and actions through equipment implanted in her body. So we're not really asking ourselves as we read that, gee, this would be really traumatic, because those are not really the questions you ask in a spy story, ideally. It's like in the way that a murder mystery is not about the grieving process. Yeah. But, you know, someone died, and there would be another way to look at that story, but that's not really what we look to a murder mystery for. Mm. So I thought, okay, what happens to Lulu afterward? And that email chapter was where I finally found a way to tell that story. But that was another case of having a wish to use an epistolary form, yeah, because it's as old as the novel itself. I mean, the 18th century novel there are a lot of epistolary novels there. And one in particular that I read recently, Clarissa, I think the longest novel written in English, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I thought, great, let's do it. Let's do these emails or whatever they are. I don't nail it down because it's 2034 by that time. But it's funny, the fun of it turned out to be, and I wasn't expecting this, watching the strategizing and the conniving and the manipulation people are trying to exert over each other, often a little bit blunderingly. But that became really fun, that it becomes a way of looking behind people's backs continuously, because of course they're talking about each other sometimes.
Yeah, carrying on conversations about each other, trying to get something out of each other. That was the voyeuristic fun of it, I think.
Everyone's trying to get something.
Yeah,
exactly.
Definitely.
Not in a malevolent way, but in a self-interested way.
Yeah. Like you said, that section is set in the future. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the new technology that's in the novel, Own Your Unconscious. And if you could explain a little bit, I know this book just came out this week, so it might be new.
So Own Your Unconscious is a machine that allows people to externalize the entirety of their consciousnesses, their memories, every perception and thought they've had since the moment of their birth, onto a beautiful, sleek cube. And they can just leave it at that and view. There are lots of reasons to do this. I mean, you can view your own memories. You can see them differently. You can see more of them. I feel very aware of how limited I'm aware that I go over the same memories a lot, but I sometimes think, what about the moment before that? What about the moment after that? I want to see more. So there's that possibility, and it's used as a hedge against dementia. You can reinfuse healthy consciousness into a brain that is starting to have trouble and lose memory. But there's also another thing that you can do with this cube and with your externalized consciousness, which is you can upload it to the collective consciousness, which is sort of an online galaxy of shared consciousness. And the reason you might want to do that is that it is the price of being able to view everyone else's consciousnesses, just like DNA information sharing or even Napster back in the old days. You have to give to get. So people do this. And that technology is not really the point of the book, and there are chapters in which it doesn't even figure, but it is definitely a through line and one of the evolutions that I follow in the course of the book.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that, and it's not quite like a social media. It's more authentic in that it's not a curated projection of yourself. It's the unconscious projected. But I was wondering, based on all the technology that's out there now, all the mediating social networks that we have, where did the idea begin for this particular future technology?
Well, one thing is, it's not all that different from what we already have, yeah. I would argue. It's, you know, the internet contains, obviously, it goes without saying, a lot of information. Mm. And it's possible to learn a lot about someone really quickly, not just their biographies, but if you spend more time, you can start looking at family photos, you can see who their friends are, you can see things that sometimes seem pretty intimate.
Yeah.
So in that way, it just felt familiar. That didn't necessarily make me interested in it, but it made it feel sort of this moment, and yet a much more exaggerated and kind of extreme version of it. The other thing is that one thing that fascinates me is our endless craving for authenticity, which is a natural product of the fact that so much of our experience is mediated.
Yeah.
And this is not my idea. This actually connects to my class at Penn, and a number of my students are here. But one book I assigned and actually then removed from the syllabus is a book by a guy named Daniel Boorstin, and it's called The Image, and it was published in 1961. And he basically, before mass media as we know it, I mean, the Vietnam War hadn't been televised, but there was television. That was really what he was responding to, the kind of artifice of creating events for this new medium of television. And he talks about the fact that a sense of mediation and artificiality in what we experience naturally makes us crave authenticity, which the media world tries to satisfy by giving us ever greater feats of mediation and artificiality to make us think that we're experiencing something more authentic. And it's sort of incredible how I think that most of what's happening in the media world to this moment can be explained, or at least that lens is a useful one through which to look at everything. Streaming, TikTok, the wish for something raw and real is really profound. So it occurred to me that, you know, raw consciousness, I mean, it doesn't get a lot more real than that.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, I posit, a little bit with humor and tongue in cheek, that we learn that one of the consequences of this machine and its widespread use and all the sharing into the collective is that social media is now completely maligned and outdated because everyone thinks that it's way too performative, and way too full of proselytizing and self-interest. So they just want the raw consciousness.
When you were talking about authenticity, I was thinking of one of my favorite characters from the novel, Alfred, who screams in public to try and elicit authentic responses from people in what is pretty funny and also horrifying if you were one of the people he was screaming near. But that was one of my favorite parts. I was struck when reading that we do spend some time in the future and with future technologies, imagining a different way that we would all live together in this collective unconscious in a way, but the novel itself doesn't feel like dystopia in any way or necessarily like a hopeless future, which is nice and refreshing, I think, to look towards the future and see some hopefulness or possibility was a good read for me anyway. But I was wondering how you're thinking about that writing into the future and not having the outcome automatically be super dire, I guess.
It's kind of fascinating because I think as a human, I feel a lot of dread. I'm really aware of that, you know, especially environmentally. I just feel every moment I'm thinking about that in some way. So it is, I was surprised myself at the optimism that really genuine optimism that shines through here. And it actually made me feel more optimistic to write it, not just because I thought, oh, I think I am optimistic, but because I feel like it just reminded me. And in a way, the pandemic has reminded me of this too, although it's been another reason to feel a lot of dread, is just that humans are so resourceful. We have so much energy, and we can adapt really easily to our circumstances. Yeah. And when we work together, which is the big sticking point in our country right now, but when we work together, we can accomplish amazing things. And somehow that ended up being the story that I was telling here, not the story of the dread I was feeling, especially when I wrote the later chapters, which were after Trump was elected. After 2016, I felt more dread.
Yeah.
Some of this I wrote before that. So I think the other thing, honestly, is that In a way, I think I was bored of my dread. It feels too easy in our current climate, where we have an existential threat in terms of the climate crisis, and we have other immediate threats of viruses and war now. Somehow, to just explore a negative vision, it's not that I have anything against that. It just doesn't feel fresh. It feels like I'm replicating the world that I live in almost too closely. And for me, when something has been established, I want to work against it. That's my basic impulse. So maybe that was what it was.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the sections in the novel, the way it's divided. Build, break, drop, build, which I know is borrowed from EDM, electronic dance music. How did you get there? I know Goon Squad was a really musical novel. Maybe this one a little bit less so, but this overarching sectioning, I would love to know.
Well, it is not as much about music as you say, and that was really a choice. I mean, it was not, I didn't want to write more about music, and also I felt that that would be asserting a connection to Goon Squad that I didn't want to follow through on. But I do listen to music often thinking about how I can do what it's doing in fiction. So, and I'm not musical. I don't play an instrument. I don't read music. But I guess maybe I do everything thinking, how can I use this for fiction? So maybe it's not just music. But A Visit from the Goon Squad is structured very overtly like a concept album. And, you know, in a concept album, and I grew up in the 70s, which I do think was the great era of concept albums, although I realize there are some good ones more recently, too. But, you know, it's a big story, if you will, kind of loose story told in small pieces that sound very different from each other and yet work together to tell the story. And I wasn't really consciously thinking I'm going to write this as a concept album, because I think I might have thought that was a little too neat as a structure. But since I didn't know I was doing it, by the time I realized it, I had sort of already done it. For this book, I also was thinking about music, but I was thinking more about songs that don't follow a kind of classic pop song structure, but more songs, and there was a particular one by Nada Surf, which is an indie band I like, called Paper Boats, where there's a recessed rhythm that asserts itself, becomes more pronounced as the song nears its close. And at that point, I realized that I've been hearing it the whole time, but I'm just noticing it now. And I thought, I like that as a structural principle. It's not a return, it's a gradual assertion. So I was thinking about that as I worked on this, and I guess one thing it showed me was I wanted to use music as structure but not a concept album. And then I honestly didn't know those terms, because I don't know much about EDM, although I do like it. And when I heard those terms, which were described by someone who worked in tech and was describing the way that EDM, the structures of those songs, or really it's a DJ term, because the idea is that you build a song, the song is building, then there's sort of a break when a new rhythm begins to assert itself, and then there's the drop when the new song basically comes in and just displaces the old. And it's a little like that feeling I had with Nada Surf. A recessed rhythm comes to the fore and indeed just takes over. And when she said that this described her feeling when she was working in tech, that it seemed to somehow mimic the experience she was having doing that work, I thought, I got to think about that. So I was listening to some EDM and thinking, I like the idea of structuring my book in that way, so that I move from one rhythm to another without telling one big story in small pieces the way a concept album is.
Yeah, I think I can see that too, in which chapters are under each section, I think. I was kind of also wondering in that vein, switching gears between different chapters, how you're going from so many different point of views and styles chapter to chapter, and in your writing process, how you manage that. From going, I'm thinking of one chapter that's told in a voice of a like preteen girl. We have our emails, we have our tweets chapter, sometimes first person, sometimes like a case study written by someone about someone else. When you're doing your drafting, how conscious are you switching between those modes?
It can be a little hard to make the switch because voice is always a tricky thing. And one of the goals of these books is to have a totally different voice for each chapter, which you don't expect from a novel. Yeah. And it's the reason I remain not totally sure these are novels, but whatever. They sell better if you call them novels. and no one buys them at all if you don't call them anything. We learned that with A Visit from the Goon Squad. So when I was writing Goon Squad, I used music to help me make those switches, and it really did help. And it made sense because I was writing about different musical eras, and I was actually revisiting them to some degree, like the grunge moment, punk rock of the 70s. This doesn't do that. So the answer is I don't exactly know, but I think that it's interesting. The machine that we were discussing, Own Your Unconscious, didn't come into focus for me for a long time. I knew that my character, Bix, and he was someone I wrote about back in 2012, I knew that he was a tech guy who was really famous, and he needs a new idea, and he's desperate for a new idea because he feels like he's already exhausted all of his insight, and he's 41. He is world famous, but he wants more. I knew he would invent something that would be really important in the book, but I didn't know what the invention would be. And then, kind of out of the corner of my eye, there were a couple of mentions of things in the, well, first of all, Lulu has spyware implanted in her body, so we know we're sort of heading into a world where internal and external with respect to technology are kind of getting melded. But there are mentions of being able to glimpse other people's consciousnesses, but I wasn't sure how. And at a certain point, someone in my writing group, and I dedicated this book to them, actually, because we met every week during the first year of COVID, and it was so incredibly helpful. When I read them that chapter from the stream of consciousness of the 13-year-old girl who's, like, hysterical over everything, and she's constantly thinking in all caps, he said, David, you know, it's kind of like you're using that machine that I had touched on briefly in another chapter. It's kind of like we're using that machine to look at her thoughts. And when he said that, the penny really dropped because I realized that actually I don't really need to recalibrate. I'm moving through the collective as if I were using this machine. And the nature of it is we're in a different place each time.
Yeah, that really felt true as I was going through and reading. It felt like a way of experiencing that machine through fiction. And I think that this book has some kind of self-awareness and meta moments of storytelling and fiction. Another one of my favorite parts is Chris Salazar, who's Benny's son from Goon Squad. One of his earlier jobs, I think, is he quantifies story tropes into algebraic equations. So, like, the makeover montage becomes like an algebraic equation. I loved that. And I thought that there was another moment with Dungeons and Dragons and self-storytelling. It seemed like the novel was being a little bit playful, I think, in that way, and acknowledging the role of fiction.
Absolutely. And actually, I mean, role-playing games were a part of the genesis of this, again, for a very domestic reason, which is that my younger son was really into Dungeons and Dragons, and we hosted a weekly group where he and his friends would meet, and I would always bake for them while they were having their group, and that allowed me to be in the kitchen where they were meeting and kind of overhearing the game. And I got really interested in how much numbers and kind of quantifying figured in that game. I loved listening to people make characters because they would roll a dice and then ascribe numerical values to personality traits and skills. And if you do that, you end up with someone who's strong in some areas, weak in other areas, has certain interests, like kind of like a human. Yeah. And so that was really fascinating to me. And so the idea of role-playing games, of creating these worlds on graph paper and moving players between them in this number-oriented way was really deep in this project, actually, and I think it peaks out here and there. And the other kid-related element is baseball, which comes up, you know, many times in the book. Yeah. And actually, those same days when we were hosting Dungeons and Dragons, my other son was upstairs orchestrating Stratomatic games. I don't know if anyone knows that. It's a game you play on paper. It's totally statistical, and you're having a base. I guess it's, I don't know if it's like fantasy baseball, but it's all on paper. Anyway, they were doing that. So I was baking for both groups. And baseball, too, has a very measurable quality to it. Yeah. So that kind of paradox of the relationship between the way that storytelling is infinite and unique and specific, and yet the way that statistics and data and numbers figured in the underpinnings of both of these games, yeah, baseball and role-playing games like D&D, really interested me.
Well, before we go to some audience questions, I have one last question for you. So since Goon Squad sparked the imagination into what this book became in some ways, do you see anything happening with this book going forward? Any characters popping out? And if not, what else might you be working on at the moment that you might want to share?
Well, I don't think it would happen for a while. It would take a while again. I would love it. I feel more like I'm here, I'm available. are they going to show up? There's definitely someone I'm interested in writing about and a way I want to try it. I had a great structural idea that didn't work in this book, which I'm not going to name only because I don't want to jinx it, and I don't know if I can ever make it work. But so I'll keep cracking at it and see what happens. But I think in the meantime, I'm really interested in, I have a couple of things that may or may not have legs. I love the thought of writing a detective novel. I really like detective novels. And I also have long wanted to, this will be a big project, but I'd like to write a novel set in 19th century New York.
Okay.
That's gonna be a
big
heavy
swing.
Lift, yeah. Research-wise. But I feel like I have sort of a voice approach, so that feels good. So cool. We'll see.
Exciting. All right, well, I think we've got some mics coming down on the side if anyone has a question.
My question is, have you ever, and if not, would you consider writing or putting together like a Spotify playlist for like, these are the songs that I listened to while writing this book, or these are like some of the inspirations I had, or YouTube playlists? I know we're not all Spotify.
I have done all of the above. I did that for Goon Squad, and actually, so this is, I'm glad you asked that question, because I want to mention my website, not because I'm such a huge devotee of websites, but because I've worked with two designers, and we've, I think, done some really beautiful websites, or they have, I guess I've assisted a little. And the new one has a feature, which is that you begin on a piece of graph paper, and there are little sort of nodes visible, and if you choose one, you end up looking at the first page as published of one of the chapters of The Candy House, and if you hover over the first paragraph, that it dissipates into a marked up draft, and if you hover again, it dissipates into the handwritten legal pad origin, and in some cases you can go further because there were false starts below that. So for example, the one that I mentioned that I spent so much time on and ended up with the email chapter, you can go through two failed efforts by hand. So I was really interested in that excavation, like just showing this handmade stuff and also showing how honestly bad it is before it gets to be good. Anyway, you can also, via that website, go to the Goon Squad website, which is archived. And there I have songs and links to buy those songs for every chapter, and also a list that I call Other Songs That Mattered, songs that helped me write even though they aren't in the PowerPoint chapter that has the songs. So, yeah, I loved doing that.
Cool. All of your drafts, I think, began handwritten, isn't that right?
Yes. So with fiction, yeah.
Do you just have like a giant stack of notebooks sitting somewhere?
Yes.
Under lock and key?
And I number them.
Oh,
yep.
Wow.
I keep them. Absolutely. I keep every big iteration, just so I can kind of look at the genesis.
Do you ever go back and pour through early drafts?
Not really. No. I mean, I had to find the first page of each draft for this project. No, I don't really. I guess it just feels like they're not. I mean, they've been superseded.
Yeah.
Thank you. I kind of have like two questions, like a kind of a funny one and more of a serious one. My first one is, I was just really curious, like, do you have like a couple like favorite EDM artists or songs?
Because I was terrified someone would ask me that. I don't think I do. I think I was listening more for the structure elements that persisted, and not so much for specific songs. But if I think of anyone, I'll let you know.
Thank you. And I was also gonna ask because I think I've read the Black Box chapter like a while ago, and that was actually like assigned in one of my other classes. And I was really curious and kind of surprised to hear you say that, because it was taking form as like a spy genre. Like, it wasn't like the trauma of like Lulu's work, all of that. It wasn't really almost, I wasn't sure if it was like your focus while you were writing it, but I was like thinking back to that chapter, and part of like Lulu's work, like she had to do some like espionage work that was like almost equivalent to assault on her body, and like the traumatic aspect of it, like the way you almost kind of like described her trauma and out of body experiences, like that was the most memorable part for me from that chapter. So I was wondering, like, would you say if you set out to write like a mystery novel or like a detective novel and you put these things in there, is that like the wrong approach?
Or
like,
no, oh my God, response? Nothing is ever wrong if you can get away with it. No, and you're right. I mean, it's true that I don't mean to say that we aren't aware that really bad things are happening to her, but it isn't really the focus of that story. And the thing that made it so hard to return to her was that I felt like then I had to reckon in a real way with what had occurred during the spy story, where we're just kind of watching the story unfold and it's told in a very fast-paced way. But it's exactly as you say, it was the reckoning that I found so hard to contend with, because a lot of things happened to her that are unbelievably problematic. So no, I would never say that. And in fact, you know, if you could write a murder mystery that is also really about the grieving process, do it. The only rule is it fun? Like, do you get away with it? Does it hold the reader? And if the answer is yes, you did it.
I don't know if, well, first of all, I would like to say how complex the book is, so that we can approach it from so many angles that it's really, you know, an unfinished story. You said the book is open, but it's more than open. It's just multi-layered and all of that. One of the things that struck me was, on your own unconscious, could it be a metaphor for writing? And the collective that comes in afterwards, could that be a metaphor for the process of reading? It seems to me that the writer feels the imperative of going so deep as to own the unconscious, but then also feels that it has to relinquish what has gathered, what the writer has gathered, what the story has produced in the material forms, the multiple material forms of the story. So that becomes the collective. It means that when the author is dead, the reader is born, but in a totally new formulated way, certainly not the way in which it was formulated in the 60s and the 70s.
That's really interesting. I think that works. You know, the sense that in some way, I mean, I am very aware of drawing on my unconscious when I write, because if I'm just using my conscious mind, I don't have enough. I need more than that. And it's also true that, you know, publishing a book is very much like releasing it into a collective where it will be interpreted in all kinds of ways that I can't control. And you made the point that it doesn't seem dystopian, but interestingly, many people perceive it to be dystopian, which I find so surprising, but they're not wrong. I mean, there's no wrong interpretation. If someone reads it and that's how it reads, then that's what it is. So I think that's really cool. Thank you. My former professor from UPenn. Still teaching me. Thank you.
Hi, I taught your novel for about 10 years to high school students, and I think the most fascinating part for them was locating different allusions, different sort of inputs that you've mentioned a couple of that have kind of made their way into the new novel. And I'm wondering, so like Greek mythology, philosophy, sort of different items in your backpack that have made their way in, and if you could give us any sort of Easter eggs in this novel.
Well, that's a great question. They usually those a lot of those resonances are not in my backpack. That's why I need my unconscious. My backpack is often like a little light. So I tend to notice those elements, and I'm glad to find them there, but I don't necessarily put them there, and that is exactly why I have to write by hand. And some of the things that I discover are so unbelievably obvious that if I had known, I wouldn't have used them. And I'll just give you two quick examples. One is that in Goon Squad, I begin and end with two people named Sasha and Alex. They have a one-night stand in the first chapter, and he remembers her in the last. And I didn't know until I had published the book that they're the same name, that Sasha is a nickname for Alexander. So that's the kind of thing, like, what? And then one other example, I wrote a story about a girl who has a crush on another girl in her grade school, and the beloved, the object of love, I named Amanda, and that means beloved in Latin. So, you know, the backpack doesn't contain that stuff, but thank God it's somewhere and I can find it. But I will give you an Easter egg. I'll give you two Easter eggs, especially because it's going to be Easter so soon. One is there's a suitcase in this novel, and we never find out exactly it seems that we never know what was in the suitcase, but actually I do tell you what was in the suitcase in the book. So you can look for that.
Ooh.
It's there. And the other thing is that I will say is that there is a tiny connection between this book and my novel, Look at Me. And that one's not hard to find. If you've read Look at Me, you'll find it, mm-hmm. probably. If you've read it recently, you'll find it. But the suitcase is a little harder. So there are some eggs for you for Easter.
I felt proud noticing that Look at Me one. That's one of my favorites. That's good. I think we have time for one more there.
Hi. I know that this is not related, but I enjoyed... I think even more than Goon Squad, I loved Manhattan Beach. And you haven't talked about it. I mean, there's no reason why you would have talked about it. But you started talking about as something you might like to do would be to do a novel about the 19th century. So I thought about the fact that in Manhattan Beach, you're going back to World War II or thereabouts. And... is there something in going back in history that is also intriguing to you and that maybe had something to do with doing Manhattan Beach?
Absolutely. I mean, while I worked on Manhattan Beach, I thought, I'm never doing this again, because it was by far the hardest book I've written. I mean, I think maybe because I rely so heavily on time and place and atmosphere, and it's the only point of connection between my fiction and my own life. I'm the opposite of an autofiction writer. I don't like writing about people like me, or I can't write about people I know. So time and place are all I've got, in a way. So writing outside my lifetime, I then didn't have that. So at first I felt like, okay, I've got nothing and I'm doing a terrible job. And I was doing a terrible job for a long time. But what I found was that when I finally crossed over, and it took some years of research and writing, into feeling fluent, and that is really the right word, actually. It felt a lot like acquiring a language to know enough about not just the little details of life, you know, what kind of cigarettes people smoke and cars they drove. That's easy. But to know what the cultural touchstones were, what people were remembering, what they were nostalgic for, what wars they had fought in, all of that, that was so exciting and so transporting that it, first of all, was incredibly fun in the moment, And it showed me New York in a completely different way. It sort of woke up the city for me. And one thing it made me aware of is just how much of the physical plant of New York is still 19th century New York. It's disappearing by the minute. I mean, buildings are just evaporating, little row houses. But there are still a lot there, and I actually have been photographing them for about 6 years. And a lot of the buildings I've photographed are gone. I can't help but I'm really interested in revisiting or visiting the and entering into the time when those structures were new and trying to reveal some of the lives that took place inside them. And I really hope I can do it.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I had so much fun chatting.
Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.